Welcome to Coaching Conversations, a weekly discussion of topics related to coaching and sport of volleyball at all levels. I'm your host, John Foreman, author of the CoachingVB.com blog and co-developer of the Volleyball Coaching Wizards Project. Let's dive right in. Welcome to episode 7 of the podcast. In this episode, the topic of discussion is the business side of our sport. It's something that I'm interested in and I definitely want to pursue throughout this series of podcasts. And recently there was an event that they call the Congress among the German volleyball collective. And my two guests, Oliver Wagner and Daniel Schmidt, were both part of it as presenters and also attendees. And I, having seen what they were going to talk about, and what obviously they eventually did talk about, I asked them to come on and share both their own subject matter and also what they heard from other participants, other speakers in the event. It was all in German, so my German is about 10 words deep, so I didn't actually attend myself. But I think this makes for an interesting conversation, and hopefully it's just the starting point of some things that will come up in future episodes. I'll give a short introduction to Daniel and Oliver at the beginning of this conversation, and then, we'll get right onto it. So I hope you enjoy this, and if you do, leave comments, or even if you don't, leave comments, suggestions, ideas. Social media, on the webpage, wherever you want to get hold of me, that's totally fine. So on we go.
Okay. So why don't we, by way of introduction, Daniel, how about you start? You'll just let listeners know what your background is.
Yeah, sure. My name is Daniel. I'm 38 years old. I'm the general manager of a little small agency for sports communications. Studied journalism and sports management with a major in sports event management. And I have been working and educated as a radio and off-air host, presenter, and announcer. And I got in contact with the volleyball and beach volleyball community in 2011. And since then, I really deeply fell in love with the volleyball community. And luckily for me, I'm currently the announcer of the German national volleyball team and, or how the FIVB would call me, like the master of ceremonies for the German national team.
All right, Oliver.
I'm Oliver from Germany, like Daniel, but now living and working in Switzerland. I'm a volleyball coach, and my original job has been a journalist. And for the past years, I was kind of diving into the topic of how to build clubs, how to help club financing through sponsorships and stuff like that.
Okay, so the two of them presented in a Congress among German volleyball aficionados, coaches, and business people recently. So that's going to be the topic of our discussion. So this is going to be very much a business side of things conversation. Oliver and I, actually, Oliver, you might be one of my very first contacts from when I started the blog back in 2013.
At least in Germany, yes.
Yeah. Because you were actually blogging at that time.
Yeah.
You since stopped doing, much to the distress of many of us, but you still tweet. And actually, I know of Daniel because you guys exchange tweets on regular basis. So when I saw that you mentioned that he was doing a session, I was like, oh, all right. Well, I at least have a sort of an idea of who Daniel is. Oliver and I actually met in 2017, I guess it was, when you were still in Germany. And you were working on Watt Volleys, which was a move to try to create a professional men's team for the first Bundesliga at that time.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, things didn't end up working out, but your experience with that is fed into the presentation that you did.
Correct. I built exactly from this moment, from this project.
Okay. So why don't we start with you, Oliver, and explain what you talked about in your presentation.
Right. It was no wonder it was about financing clubs, not only in such big projects like the Wattvollies, but also in smaller clubs. Let me point out first that this was a conference for or a congress for the German-speaking part of Europe, like Germany, Austria, Switzerland. Mm-hmm. And I'm pretty sure that most of the things we discuss apply to the rest of Europe as well. But I'm not sure about the transfer to the US, for example, because I know that there are several differences in how to organize clubs or even club volleyball or whatever. So, mm-hmm. Yes, that this is just a little question mark I have, but you guys in the US have to find out.
Yeah, yeah. We can definitely talk about that.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Great. So yeah. Why not? So I was talking about how to make your club attractive to sponsors, because in volleyball, I think we have a general problem, at least in Germany, Switzerland, whatever. You go to a possible sponsor, let's say your local bank, for example, and it's literally falling to your knees and begging for some money, because most clubs think they don't have anything to offer to the sponsor. So they are begging for money. And I was talking about that this is a huge misunderstanding, I think, because every club, even the smaller clubs, have to offer very important things for companies, for possible sponsors. The only thing you have to do is thinking outside the box.
Right. Yeah. It's an interesting perspective, because, as you say, and this happens in the US too, people think sponsorship is more of a donation,
right,
charity thing, than right, it is actually a business decision.
It is a business, yes.
Right.
Correct.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, if you're talking NBA, NFL level professional leagues, then everybody knows it's a sponsorship agreement. There's a business arrangement that goes on. Right. And even at the college level, certainly beyond kind of a very basic sort of point, the colleges understand, the universities understand, we're working with other businesses and we're trying to develop relationships with each other and work with each other. But yeah, once you start getting down the ranks where people don't think in those terms, then it's begging. It's, hey, please, sir, may you have pity on me.
Look into my eyes. Yeah, and that's the same with that's the same here in Europe, in the top leagues, in the elite leagues. Everybody knows it's a business, but the lower you get in the ranks, as you said, the people are surprised that there's nobody who just throws around with euros.
Right. Well, we can make some arguments whether they actually run things like professional organizations.
That's true.
Maybe that's a topic for another time. All right. So, all right, Daniel, what was your discussion about?
My discussion was about the eventization of sporting events, especially in volleyball. It might be useful to know for the people listening to this show that volleyball has a very difficult standing in Germany. It is not under the five top sports in Germany, and it is one of the sports that have a major loss of like participants of 4% each year. Wow. And that makes us to be honest and to tell the truth, to the top, like we're in the top five losers of the sporting industry right now. So for myself, I gave an introduction to eventization, especially for clubs who are ranked in the lower divisions, in order to like get some ideas how to create a better sporting event with a very low budget. Because that's right. Basically, if you take the Bundesliga, of course, there's a like a professional budget. But if you go beyond those divisions, like most of the sporting clubs, they are dependent on membership values, and like many of them, they don't have really a high budget. So I try to give them like some ideas how to create a good sporting event with just like fixing some minor ideas in order to like get like on a process to professionalism.
Sure. Yeah, and structurally, it's worth noting that in Germany and in many places in the world, once you get past the professional ranks, volleyball club structure there looks a lot like kind of regionalized club structures in the U.S., where teams are only playing within a relatively small geographic area. Now, obviously, Germany is a bigger country than say Switzerland, so the possibility to travel is different. But you know, once you get to the second Bundesliga, they split it geographically anyway. So, whereas here in the U.S., you have a certain level of junior clubs that are traveling nationally. Yeah. To play in tournaments and spending massive amounts of money. What is the average membership cost for juniors players or even adult players playing in clubs in Germany or Switzerland?
Like throughout the sports, I can give you the exact number. It's around 112 euros per year and membership.
Wow. people listening to that in the US are falling out of their chairs right now. Yeah. Because that might not get you through a week.
You got to see the history behind this, because in Germany, like in opposite to the US, you have a lot of franchises, and like on the top level, there is like a really commercial sports system. In Germany, we're still working with federations and clubs which are dominated by memberships. And this leads to a huge gap between the divisions in economic stability.
Right.
And that is a problem why like all those members need to finance basically the whole system.
Yeah, true. Yeah. True. In Switzerland is a more expensive country than Germany is. So here I think the approximate yearly fee in a club would be around 300 Swiss francs, euros. That's more or less the same. But I really like an initiative by our federal volleyball body, Swiss Volley, they're called. And they really recommend all their clubs to take around 1,000 euros per year. Because they say it's what the job you are doing is worth this, but I know this is still far away from what you guys in the US are asking from your members.
We've had this conversation, Oliver, about, I remember you asking me at one point what can we do in Germany to justify higher membership fees?
Yeah.
And we had talked at that time, well, one of the big things over here is the targeting of college scholarships, which obviously isn't something that exists in most of the rest of the world. So for better or worse, and you could argue this in both ways, parents are willing to invest a certain amount of money in their children to play juniors volleyball in anticipation that would get paid back by them getting a scholarship to play at the university. I think if somebody actually ran the numbers on how that investment works out on average, people probably would be horrified. But so in certain parts of the country, volleyball is an extremely big business. It was something that struck me immediately when I was working in Texas is volleyball. I mean, football in Texas is football, and it's by far the biggest sport, no question about it. But for girls, volleyball is the sport, is the next sport. I mean, yeah, cheerleading's up there, but I don't think it. I don't think. But volleyball is just it was the first place that I actually lived and worked where it was a gigantic mainline sport.
Yeah.
And money gets thrown around all over the place. You have clubs are legitimate business operations there. They own their own facilities. They have 12-month programming, be it clinics, and obviously there's the junior season, but clinics and camps and individual lessons and all the hosting events and all that stuff. Whereas in a lot of parts of the country, like where I grew up in the Northeast, it maybe wasn't quite as bad as strictly volunteer, but not well paid. We'll put it that way. To the point about what you said, Swiss Volley said, is it's not reflective of the value that's being provided. If, you're only taking, like, I think the lower level teams when I was going, and I don't know what it is these days, but the teams that were only playing a regional schedule, they would practice once a week and they would play 5 tournaments a year within the region between they would start practicing in January, but the tournament schedule was basically 2 in March, 2 in April, and championships in May. Mm-hmm. And that was about a $300 expense. Mm-hmm. If you started incorporating multiple practices and or playing more tournaments further afield, then, at the club that I was at, our regional rather than local team, which would travel all over the Northeast and sometimes to New York or Pennsylvania, that was $1,500, something like that. And I think, my coaching salary was not very high. Because, you've got maybe 10 kids on the team. So, $15,000, you got to take all their uniforms and equipment out of that. All the tournament entry fees, travel expenses for the teams if you're renting vans or whatever.
Yeah.
So there's not a lot left.
No.
And most of those clubs are not-for-profit organizations. They're specifically set up to be not-profit organizations. Yeah. And I think there's a similar structure over there.
Yeah. In Europe, most clubs are in Germany, for example. You will only get a license to take part in any league if you are a non-profit organization.
Okay.
Even in the highest ranks, you talked about the first Bundesliga, you have to be a non-profit organization. I mean, that's silly. And the volleyball governing body in Germany knows that. But it's not their first priority to change that. But they, in the next years, they are going to change it because they know that's silly. Now the structure in the highest ranks is you have that club, non-profit, and they have to found a company that holds the business part of that team. That's crazy. Here in Switzerland, it's actually... To me, as a German, that's close to paradise because you don't have that non-profit thing. Okay. You can be a company. You can be – I could found a club and run it.
Right.
And I think that this is a very positive thing for the development of more attractive clubs.
Okay. So when we look at Berlin, BR Volleys,
yeah,
what is that structure? Because obviously you say the club itself, the volleyball side, has to be a nonprofit. So there is a separate entity which oversees essentially the business of the BR Volleys?
And this is with every club in the Bundesliga.
There are some bizarre corporate structures around the world different purposes. This is probably not as complicated as some things that you could find in other places to avoid certain tax restrictions or whatever. But
correct,
it definitely doesn't sound particularly efficient. This was just is a completely separate conversation. One of the things that I think we've talked about at one point is in in football, and I don't know if it applies to other of the top sports in Germany, you have a limitation on ownership, correct? How do we actually say it? Because we were looking at it in terms of volleyball, and the restriction wasn't there. It's something to do with international, like foreign ownership, or what was it?
I think you probably, correct me if I'm wrong, there is in soccer right. in Germany, there is a rule that a certain owner cannot own more than, Daniel?
50%. It's called 50%. The 50 plus one okay. rule.
Okay. Yeah, yeah, correct. Yeah. Right. But this is only in soccer, I guess. I don't think that there is a similar rule in volleyball.
Well, we can probably take a look at ice hockey in Europe, because ice hockey has a similar economic system than you practice in the US. We call mm-hmm. it a closed shop system, where you have franchises working okay. together in one league. And right. whoever owns that franchise can, for example, move that franchise. This would be unacceptable in volleyball. If Berlin right. said we want to go somewhere else, there would be a huge process behind it. If you want to move an ice hockey club from Munich to Hamburg, that's okay. I mean, you own okay. the franchise, you can take it anywhere you want.
Right.
Yeah. So we're adapting more and more to the US system, because like the sports recognizes that in order to get like a professionalized sports, we need to adjust those structures, because the structures are too old and unflexible.
Yeah, sure. Okay.
That's true. The German club system is simply not made for professional sport. This is for broader thoughts, just move the old German, I don't know the English word, the Turn, Gemeinde Turnvater Jan. Yeah. This is like hundreds of years ago, where that was for fitness and mm-hmm. people met to keep fit and healthy and whatever. And this is right. our structure is made for this.
Well, and it also has something to do with the system where you can move clubs up and down.
Right.
For example, if you have a very huge success and you got, for example, the first rank, you move up to a higher division or league. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That is something you don't have in the U.S.
That was where I was going to take that. Do they do that in hockey, or is it like here where everybody stays in the league?
They don't do it in hockey, but like, for example, in volleyball, if you perform, if a club performs very low, they move down to a mm-hmm. lower division, to a lower yep. league.
Yeah, because obviously there's been a lot of discussion about, is Major League Soccer ever going to go to a relegation promotion model?
Yeah,
and it really doesn't work in the franchise model.
No,
because you have to. I mean, the whole idea is you're kind of leveling out the finances, and if people are moving it up and down, I mean, just look at the Premier League in England, and what they have to try to figure out to do for equity's sake with teams that get relegated. And they get paid out for X number of years from the TV contract. I mean, it's no wonder they're always talking about we're going to do that. We're going to break away, or we're going to just isolate and just have our own league. Or just, yeah, well, we'll see where it ends up going. It'll be interesting. I mean, what we've talked about in terms of the wild cards, which is what you were pursuing with What Volleys, kind of almost goes along that line of we want to introduce more teams in without having to go through the structure yeah. as long as they meet certain requirements.
Yeah, that's true, but that's still I think, and I know Daniel and me had that discussion before, I still think you have to get rid of that relegation system, because I know right now you can be the worst team in the first league in Germany and you will never ever relegate, because nobody wants to get up.
Yeah.
So, but this is as soon as there is somebody, you go down. And who in the world would put money and a lot of time, effort, energy into building something great, which is strictly connected to your success in the league.
Right.
That's not business. I don't think that business can work like this.
Well, and especially in our sport where you've only got six players on the court.
Yeah.
And if you lose your star player, that can make all the difference in the world between being an upper half team and being fighting for your life at the end of the season.
I just talked to a coaching friend here in Switzerland yesterday, and he exactly had that very problem. They lost in the very first game. They lost their best player, and now they are the worst team in the league.
Yeah, it happens.
They have no chance.
Yeah, it happened a few years ago. I think it was Arizona State. Had a phenomenal, I believe, outside hitter who got injured about midway through the season. They were being talked about as possible, certainly possibly winning the pack. Forget if it was 10 or 12 at that point. winning whatever they were, the Pac-12 at that time, being a legitimate top 10, top 5 sort of team. She got hurt and you never heard from them again. They were out of the running altogether. So. Yeah. But we digress. Daniel, let's talk to get back to where we kind of started with. Let's talk about that of the eventization and what organizations can do to actually make an event something that then Oliver can sell as, hey, this is why you should sponsor us.
Let me get into that first, please. It was just vice versa during the Congress.
Right. Yes.
I was first, and then I said, hey, and don't miss Daniel's speech, because he will tell you what you can do with the money you get from your new sponsors to be even more attractive to new sponsors. That's just funny.
Exactly. Yes, that was one of the major points of success of this Congress was like all the different speeches together made a process of thinking and creating new ideas for the club. So that made this Congress a huge success. In regards of your question, we have to make sure like that eventization is not something you do like within one day. It is a whole process, and you have to be you have to commit to it for a very long period. Everything starts with the idea that you want to satisfy your stakeholders, and you got to make sure to be aware about what stakeholders are in volleyball sports. That's not only the visitors. Those are the players, the referees, guests of honor, VIPs, the media, and in order to satisfy those stakeholders, you got to make sure you fit their needs. And like it starts with very simple thoughts. For example, if you have guests of honor, you got to provide them a different service as you would provide to a regular visitor. You would make sure that on the court, everything is set up properly. So the sporting event, that the core of the sporting event is the volleyball match. So in order to eventize everything around it, you need to make sure this works out. Referees need to be happy. The guest team needs to be treated properly. Everything with a little attention to detail. And it is about creating ideas to handle with those stakeholders in order to create emotion. Emotion is a very important factor on creating an atmosphere which is attractive to others, because humans, they learn from emotions, from positive emotions. And it is about creating moments that you remember through emotions. And this could be, for example, if you have a specific way of cheering your team, for example, or having an interesting show between the sets or anything like this. And we tried to give some ideas how to start that process during the Congress.
Okay. Yeah, it's been interesting for me. I had a chance to go to a few BR Volleys matches when Mark Lebedew was the coach and experience Max Schmeling and what that was like. I was there for Champions League matches. I was there for some regular season matches. And they obviously do a quite good job of making a good event. One of the issues I always have here with the folks that don't really think about the event as the full package of what it is, like especially the emotional side of it that you just talked about, is they'll think, okay, what do we want to do to make things more interesting and engage people? Well, we'll have a serving contest between sets 2 and 3 when the teams are off having a break. Like, well, okay. You know, maybe you'll get a couple of people that'll be interested in that, but does that really stimulate the rest of it?
No, it doesn't.
I mean, that's a little fun distraction, you know, in the middle of things, but what is it doing to engage the people and what's actually happening on the court and to engage your organization?
Yeah, this pretty much is a great example of lack of fantasy. Because that is very popular in Germany to do this kind of put some people on the court and let they do something to fill this break. I like to figure out and point out that with some ideas and with a little creativity, you can really create different approaches which are much more attractive to the audience. Instead of doing just those regular things everyone does, you need a little courage and you need to try out different approaches. It's not, oh, okay, I have an idea. I'm going to try it and it works out. Normally you got to do 2 or 3 approaches, try different things, get different attraction in order to get something that is interesting for the audience. But
right.
I agree. It's definitely no fun to see some people trying to do some volleyball serves in the breaks. Yeah.
I mean, I can appreciate having the dance troops or the tumblers or whoever they have while the teams are in their timeouts and stuff like that. It's a nice distraction when there's nothing else happening. But, you know, it's not – at the end of the day, that's a minor part to me of the event experience.
But let me just add, Berlin is a great example because we need to take a look at how Berlin started. They started in a different sports arena, which was much smaller than Max Schmeling Hall is today. And they had a long breath. They tried and tried and tried and kept on improving themselves in order to give a great event. The thing we see today is a top-level event in regards of volleyball in Germany. There's another factor. Eventization in Germany is very young. The U.S. created sports in a different approach. In the U.S., for example, American football is a sport where from the very beginning, entertainment was included in the concept. Mm-hmm. So this is basically new for Germany. And as you know, Germans are pretty conservative. So the whole thing about eventization is still in there, it's like a little child. This is not yet developed.
Right. Yeah. The professional leagues here, they get it. They know they have to have a game day experience, especially because everything's available on television these days.
Or
highlight videos or whatever. So people don't have to come to the event near, as much as it used to be before TV and, I mean, even before radio, if you want to go back way, 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 way back. It's interesting to look at spectator crowd sizes now compared to what they used to be way, way back, accepting the fact that they're part of it is a function of safety requirements. You're not going to get 100,000 people in a football ground anymore because they're all standing next to each other. And we know we've had too many problems. Come of that, but you still have to find ways of creating that atmosphere, and to your point, you know, everybody's doing the same thing. All these organizations are not the same. All these events are not the same. They should have their own feel about them, their own texture and experience.
Well, a great example is the Volleyball Nations League, where the FIVB tries to get approach throughout all nations. Mm-hmm. And like, if you switch into the stream, like from different nations, everything is the same. The schedule is the same. The procedure is the same. Even the cheering is the same. Mm-hmm. And nevertheless, the approach in the countries is way different. Like in Germany, we're okay with this. But if you, for example, take a look at Russia or Iran, you see the people there, they have a different mentality and really struggle with this kind of cheering, for example.
Right.
And this shows that like regional aspects are very important in creating a good event.
Yeah. I mean, it's good the FIVB is doing these things to try to create more of an experience. You wonder about the trade-off of the in-arena experience versus the television streaming experience, because they kind of contradict in certain places.
Yeah.
Where what's happening in the arena is probably great for the people in the arena, but those of us watching on the other side of the world are going, yeah, it's kind of annoying.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, so Oliver, we've developed a great event that, you know, people want to come to, that we can associate with our brand as a club. There's a term that everybody likes to use these days. So what's the, from the sponsor's perspective, how do we look at things from the what's in it for them point of view, rather than the please, sir, will you donate to my cause?
Yes. I think that the huge problem we have in volleyball is that it's not televised. Or if it is, like in Germany, we have those really ugly streams it's just horrible. You'd be lucky if that camera follows the ball. So if you see half of the game, that's a good stream. So you have to find something else you can offer, because you don't have those masses of fans watching. You have like even in Berlin. So which sponsor? Berlin, I think, has a budget of something between 3 and 4 million per season. So which sponsor, let's say the name sponsor, I'm just guessing, is giving $1 million. So which sponsor pays $1 million for, let's say, 15 home matches with 5,000 people in the gym? Nobody. So what you have to do, and I think the future of involving sponsors into volleyball is campaigns. It's not you get your name printed on the dress, you'll be seen on these banden,
banners, and signage.
So I think this is only a minor part. Mm-hmm. And this is only worth anything if we start providing good television streams or whatever. For example, here in Switzerland, I really like that public TV station is streaming a lot of first league volleyball. That's good. And so you have a real something you can weigh in if you talk with the sponsor. But in most parts, I think it has to be campaigns. So think outside the box, what you can offer. As a small club, for example, I use that example. What the sponsor has a kind of summer party for its own customers or partners, friends, whatever. So as a volleyball club, what you have to offer is the personal. You have club members, you have parents, you have kids, whatever they need, that they can help serving at this party. They can offer drinks, they can help washing the dishes. And so this is a real value you have to offer, which the sponsor doesn't have to pay anymore for these kind of services. So there's a real value, I think, you have. Or if you have good ideas, good for campaigns that attract a huge public, your local, regional radio station, newspapers, whatever, they are always looking for good stories. And if you can combine an idea with your sponsor, I use that example for, I don't know how it is in the US, but in all over Europe, you have these spring cleaning happenings, I call them, where the whole city meets and they start cleaning up what was the waste that mounted up during the winter time. Mm-hmm. So that we clean our city, we make it green again. So, and this is I think an ideal idea for some sponsors who offer like gardening tools or whatever, to combine those two ideas, that cleaning up, making a positive shout out to the rest, and then make sure that this connection between the sponsor and the club is to be seen.
Mm-hmm.
You always need the newspaper or a huge YouTube channel or whatever to combine this, because the only thing that really helps a sponsor is people watching, people seeing.
And one of the things that people often don't think about is that, yes, there's definitely value in having a bigger audience, a broader exposure, and expanding your exposure to more people. But from a business's perspective, a lot of times having a more narrowly focused audience that they know speaks specifically to whatever their product or service is,
that
is their target, that they know exactly who these people are, and they can direct things much better at them than some sort of broad scatter approach that is normal advertising.
Yeah,
that's usually valuable.
Yeah, that's a very good point. So sometimes even you might find a sponsor who is pretty happy with the 200 people watching that game.
Mm-hmm.
He's happy with that because he knows these are the 200 people that really fit into my philosophy or might become new customers. And think about that. If that guy is selling cars, he only needs one person to buy a car, and probably he is at
Brady. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Just paid for your sponsorship.
Yeah.
I guess you guys have a very important point. I think many sports clubs do not know much about their audience and their members. Like, that is a common mistake we see in Europe very often, that the people don't know about the demography that their own members or visitors have. Mm-hmm. And as you said, John, this is a major key to success, I think, because companies are really focusing on target groups, on the segmentation of the people they like to communicate with. And if you don't know your own stakeholders, your own structure of visitors, of people around you, you don't have like a conclusion to make sure the sponsor is happy.
You can't define the value to a potential sponsor or advertiser or whatever. And that's
in this case, you don't have the numbers and you don't have the knowledge about the people you were advertising. Right. Yeah.
Daniel, as a master of ceremonies, what are the things that you bring to help engage people and make for a better experience and can also be involved in giving better sponsor experience or VIP experiences?
I try to increase the emotionality of a match by creating a thought of community in the arena. It is very important. First of all, let's say there's a difference between a master of ceremony, for example, for the national team, because I don't have a specific target group, or if I'm master of ceremony for my home team, because I know very well what they want, how they are cheering, etc. But my approach is to create an atmosphere where the people try to connect through rituals. For example, if you do a wave or a common cheering together, people feel connected to each other, although they don't know each other. And that creates an atmosphere where you can increase the emotions of each attendee. And I guess that is very important, especially for a match which is exciting, which is very close. For example, if I have a five-setter as a master of ceremonies, in a five-setter, I must be very aware that this fifth set must be the highlight of the game. There must be an explosion of emotions, no matter how the result is. My goal is to create an event which is filled with emotion in order to be independent from the result of the game. And this is what sponsors find attractive as well. They want to send their positive messages to their target group, no matter how the result is. I'm probably in a club which has a very bad season. So still the sponsor wants to get recognized as a positive influencer of this club. So, I like to make sure everything is a social thought.
Yeah. Yeah. One of the things that kind of frustrates me going to different places in the U.S. is you have somebody who will call out the result of a play or, hey, kill for Smith. Okay. That's it. They'll tell you when people are substituting for each other.
Yeah, so this person misses out a lot of tasks which you need to fulfill with a sporting event, which is action. I need to get people involved into the match by creating interaction. I need to, as I said, create emotion, but also information is one of the jobs for a master of ceremonies as well. So this is one part, but you don't need to forget the other parts.
Right. Yeah, one of the frustrations I think for a lot of volleyball people in the U.S. is it's been very common for years that at the beginning of, say, an ESPN broadcast match, they'll start with the rules. It's best 3 out of 5, play to 25, unless it's the fifth set. And you just go, why? Do you ever do this for an NFL game? Do you ever do this for basketball or baseball? No, you don't, because you expect that the people who come to the game, generally speaking, understand your sport. Now, are there going to be new people? Sure, of course there are. But they'll figure it out along the way.
No, I probably would disagree to this. If we take a look at beach volleyball, for example, beach volleyball is living from lifestyle. The people there to get seen, to be involved in a huge party. But for example, if I host beach volleyball matches, I have a lot of people probably who are at the beach. They're taking a look at this. Oh, what are those guys doing? So I, from time to time, I need those explanations. Right. But I can understand that those explanations frustrate the people who are very close to a sport because they know everything. Yeah. But from time to time, I think it's okay to do this.
Yeah. Go ahead.
I would like to make a difference between information for the broadcast and information within the gym. Sure. A very good example to me is what the NFL Europe did during their days in Europe. And that was, I really liked that because it was pretty clear that not everybody in the stadium knew the rules of American football.
Yeah.
So they had these information volunteers, I want to call them, who were dressed in the referee's uniform, and they were just patrolling through the ranks and asking, so who needs an explanation? So during the game, and there were people, new families, new to the game, and they said, hey, can you help me? And then they were sitting down beside them and were explaining the rules. And I really like that because I still think the eventization is very, very important, but there is still the sport, and you need to understand it at least in its basics.
Yeah.
So I really like that, but I'm pretty sure that I would get annoyed as well if they do that before every broadcast.
Yeah, I can. To your point about the beach, Daniel, I can. Where you have people just randomly walking into the event, it totally makes sense because you never know who's going to know what's going on. A lot of people who will know volleyball but won't know the difference between the indoor sport and the outdoor sport, especially with some of the innovations that have taken place, like the freeze and some things like
right,
that.
I agree.
It's like, wait, why isn't the score changing? Well, because we're playing partly modern volleyball and partly old volleyball. So, it's just all, as you said, you got to think about all of the possible people that you're trying to influence and reach and how you have to hit them in different ways and on different levels. I know there were some other sessions, Oliver, you mentioned there were some other sessions kind of along these lines. Did either of you attend any of those? And if so, what did you kind of pick up from them?
So I really liked one other session that was with a professor in... Daniel, help me. He was a professor in
sports management because he was my professor.
Okay,
to be honest.
Okay, so probably you would talk about his speech.
He was talking about how to cope with a coronavirus situation because he noticed that many sports clubs, they just try to hide. And say, okay, it's a crisis now. I don't know what to do. And they just start to freeze. They do nothing. Mm-hmm. And he tried to explain the process of how to cope a crisis and how to apply this to your sports club. So he figured out that basically this is a very great time to start innovating your club because – to be honest, you've got nothing to lose because your finance is low. You need to do some action. You know you are forced to react. Mm-hmm. And he figured out that with some mind changing, it is a great time now to influence the people in your club and to create new ideas.
And what really struck me the most in that talk was at some point, he mentioned that probably at least in Germany, not many clubs really realized that they are in the middle of a crisis. They just go like, oh, I can't see, like little children. I can see it. It isn't there. And then he said that this is really dangerous. And this is what really struck me because that, kind of, I thought that before. To me, sometimes in Germany and Switzerland, at least in volleyball, it looks like, oh, let's just continue and hope that we get through this. And he said at one point, yeah, that's pretty dangerous for the business side of it. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's one of the things that I look at with our sport is it's not strong in sustainability. I mean, Germany's got a very good setup in terms of to be in the Bundesliga, you have to demonstrate, what, is it 3 years forward financial arrangements? Is that, am I right with that, Oliver?
Yep, so, part of, yeah. They have kind of, if you are, the measures are different. They depend on how long you are a member of the first league. If you are, I think the highest thing is, if you are eight years in the league, you have to have three full-time management jobs filled, and the arena, and yeah, whatever. This mm-hmm. is just, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, at least there is the realization that we can't be looking at things on a year-to-year basis, because if you're doing that, somebody loses a sponsor, now they can't compete. We've seen this in Germany in lower divisions, where teams have been in the second Bundesliga for years, and were even challenging to try to get promotion. They lose a sponsor, and now they've decided, well, we have to drop out of the Bundesliga altogether. We have to drop down to the regional league, and that's a problem with our sport across the board. I mean, even in places like Poland, which is, you would look at and go, that's one of the best volleyball environments in the world. But if something happens one year and a club just disappears, they can't field the team that season.
There's another aspect, John, which fits very good. And this is to refer to this Congress. We need to see the history. Like, the German Volleyball Federation has a very difficult year behind them, mm-hmm. because first of all, there were some beach volleyball players installing their own beach cup. Now we have two individuals who said, okay, we need to have a digital approach to connect volleyball players, trainers, coaches, whoever, together. And like, the whole interpretation sovereignty went away from the federation. Like, everybody is digitalizing their businesses, but mm-hmm. not the federation. And this is a problem in structure. And I guess many countries have the same problem, that the clubs are far ahead in pushing digital innovations now. And the federations, they're like just stuck in their own old structures, and they're not doing anything right now. And this is, as far as I would consider it, is a huge problem in Germany.
Yeah, I could see that being a problem anywhere, because the clubs, the businesses are incentivized to keep on top of things and keep being able to engage their constituencies where they are at, which is online, you know, digital in many, many ways. Whereas, you know, the federations are just taking in the money from the work that everybody else is doing, essentially. Yes, they have programs and structures to try to benefit the sport broadly, but some of that stuff is at odds with what some of the constituent groups are, you know. And that is just one of the things that I ran into in England, is you've got a part of it, part of the clubs that are thinking competitively, and then you've got some of them that are more focused on the participation and trying to grow the sport. And there's overlap, to be sure, but you run into conflicts. And I saw this just within the club, where I was trying to train a team for the first division, and we were having people coming in to practice who were not ever going to be playing on that team, but they wanted the fees and they wanted to encourage more people to be involved. It's like, well, okay, well, what do you want? Do you want to compete and stay in the first division, or get relegated and worry about bringing more people in? So in a lot of places, they need to find that balance of, well, what's our big priority now, so we can put the resources toward that. So any other things that you guys picked up from other conversations?
I found pretty interesting one topic that was about, or that was actually two different talks with a similar topic. It was about helping clubs with more volunteers and engagement. How could you engage the volunteers who are obviously there? In Germany, for a fact, he presented a lot of numbers, and there are even younger people who are interested in volunteering, but what can you do for them? And how does a structure have to look like to help them deciding to work for your club? Mm-hmm. And this again is I think it's always the same thing. We recognize more and more that our regular clubs are not built for doing modern things.
Right.
Because this is, again, this is if you want to have young people being engaged in your club, helping with things outside the team thing, like, let's say, at home games with the financial side of a club, whatever, you have to be attractive for them. Mm-hmm. It's their free time, their leisure time. So they want to have fun,
yeah,
while doing this. And look at at least look at a German club structure. There's no fun at all. I mean, this is two different worlds meeting.
Well, yeah, and I think that speaks to what Daniel was saying about the events and all of the different stakeholders. You know, the people who work the event are part of the stakeholders.
Yes, they are.
And they should have a good experience too. They should want to come back. They should want to evangelize. Hey, this is a great, you should come to this. This is an awesome experience, whether it's to come work or to come attend or whatever.
Right. And tell your friends. This is, I know this is not the business side, but another topic was how to get more youth or young players to play for your club. Mm-hmm. Same arguments.
Yeah.
Fun. They are kids. They want to play. They want to have fun.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, gentlemen, any final thoughts? Any last words?
It has been a great Congress. It has been the first of this type. And as I've seen on the Congress's website today, they even scheduled 2021 already. So I'm really looking forward to it. And it was a great opportunity to get connected with a lot of people having the same problems and issues. So I can just encourage everybody to use the digital media to stay in contact, to discover new topics, new people, extend the network. It has been a great event. Very good.
And it has been 1,500 plus attendees, which is a huge number, I think, for the very small volleyball community of Germany, Austria, and Switzerland. That was enormous yeah. numbers.
All right. So I know both of you are on Twitter. Is there any other place that you'd like people to go to follow you?
Well, I'm on Twitter, on LinkedIn. Guess you can find me anywhere on social media. I'm very, very busy in the social media.
All right.
Yeah, I'm more the old man. I'm on Twitter. Yes, I am, and I like Twitter more than Facebook. I'm on Parler, but yeah, that's all.
All right, and Oliver, you're Volley Blogger on Twitter.
Yes, Daniel? Yeah, that's at Volley Blogger.
Yeah, Daniel, what are you?
I have my name, Daniel R. Schmidt, so.
Okay, all right, easy.
There are too many Wagners and too many Olivers in the world, so you can not find an email address or any account with my name.
All right, well, thanks a lot, guys. I want to continue this whole conversation about the business side of the sport. So this is a good way to get it started with the podcast. Appreciate it.
Thanks for listening. Check out the show notes on the website, coachingvb.com, for links and further information about this episode. You'll also be able to find the complete back catalog prior coaching conversation. While you're there, you can sign up for my mailing list. No Members find out in advance what conversations I'll be doing next and can submit questions if they like. If you'd like to support this podcast, go to patreon.com/coachingvb. Patrons get early access to every episode, as well as other special benefits along the way. I'm always interested in hearing what you think about coaching conversations and ideas you might have of topics and or guests for future episodes. You can send them to me at john@coachingvb.com, tweet them to @coachingvb, or hit me up on my Facebook page, Coaching Volleyball. All the best until next time.